So, first of all, I've seen a lot of familiar faces from yesterday, so I won't beat this horse too hard. We'll try to whip through some of the stuff that we presented earlier, and we'll try to carry over with some of the more extensive information. But first of all, thank you for the praise. We appreciate it, and you know, we really would not have had the opportunity to be here today if Dr. Durista hadn't gotten involved and approached us in the first place. So, we've already covered the financial disclosures, but thanks to Dr. Durista, we've been able to come here and represent our group today. So, what you were saying before about the Amputation Prevention Initiative, we have basically four phases, and I'm going to be speaking mainly on the first two. Emily will be covering the last two. And so, just briefly, amputations are huge problem with relationship to diabetes in the U.S. With almost 600,000 people living currently with those amputations. Lower extremity amputations outnumber upper extremity amputations amongst diabetics 26-1, and 62.8% on a national basis are midfoot amputations or higher. And we right now are seeing about 82,000 amputations related to diabetes of the lower extremity a year. Now, we found that the survivability for diabetics and non-diabetics following amputation are close, but overall we find that they're a little bit worse on diabetics. And we find that the more proximal you go on your amputation, the higher the risk is for having a negative outcome. This is true regardless of at the toe, the ray, the midfoot, BK, AK, and so on. And it can actually have an impact on whether or not your risk of having an amputation on the same foot or on the other foot over a 1 year, 5 year period. So the phase one was just identifying diabetic patients who had an ICD-9 code of 250 plus or a amputation code of the lower extremity of 84.10 to 84.19 during the same hospitalization. And we took those amputation information and we average them out to get a real reflection of what the true amputation rate is over a 4 year period. We then age adjusted this to the 2000 census, which is basic standard protocol at this time for doing comparisons on rates. We then compared this to the state population of adults in 2004, and we were able to get our rate per 1000 diabetics by taking that rate and number of amputations and including BRFSS data on the prevalence of diabetes within the state. What we found was that indeed diabetes is much higher in the state of Massachusetts, but it follows a similar linear trend. Also, we found that our amputation rates seem to be lower compared to the general population, as well as amongst our diabetics themselves. Now, when you look at these numbers, they look fairly similar in terms of our rate per the general population, as well as even at the per 1,000 diabetic level. However, if we look a little bit closer, we find that the rate of amputations in our state, in Massachusetts, we have much higher proportion of digital amputations versus midfoot amputations and higher. We found that this was fairly consistent throughout consecutive years. The proportion and the relationship seemed to be fairly maintained. And once we pooled all those, what we found was that 58% of our amputations were either digital, and 17% were midfoot, and the remaining 25% were either AK or BK. And so when we compared this to previous literature, we find that amputations in Massachusetts tend to be more at the foot level itself, at the toe and the midfoot level, versus at the national level, it tends to be more along the BK and AK, the major amputations. The next part of this project was to go and identify who are the high-risk groups, who's most likely to have this outcome based on age, gender, race, and ethnicity. And as you'd expect, we found that there was a larger trend to have amputations the older the patient got. And we also found that the relationship of gender seemed to be fairly maintained with the state level and the national level, as well as the racial and ethnicity divisions as well, as well as the age background as well. What we do find, though, when we look at the general population, is that males tend to have a 2.6 times greater rate of amputations than females. Black non-Hispanics have a 2.7 times greater rate, and those over 65 have a 4.8 times greater rate than those under 65. We then looked at this information relative to the prevalence of diabetes for these different groups. However, because of limitations on BRFSS, there's not necessarily the ability to make a causal relationship that we can link this to. We would like to look further in the future at trying to establish what socioeconomic status indicators such as education and income have on the effect of amputation rates, but at this time that information is not available. So the conclusions are simply that we know that diabetes is the leading cause of non-traumatic amputations in the U.S., that these amputations are associated with increased mortality and increased morbidity. In Massachusetts, we found that our amputations are more digital versus major, as is the norm in the national arena. And we also have found that men, non-Hispanic blacks, and those over the age of 65 tend to have a higher risk than their counterparts. So we think that strategies which focus on prevention may be the solution. As before, the limitations with this is that multiple hospitalizations can't be identified based on the databases that we're using. We also have issues where coding has been demonstrated to be miscalculated in both the diabetic, non-traumatic, and this has caused variations on what is reliable data in terms of who actually had a diabetic amputation. And finally, this information does not include any federal databases. As such, we don't have access to the VA system, which has been suggested to account for up to 10% of all diabetic amputations. So now that we know kind of amputations are bad, which I'm sure everyone's surprised about, we find that there's a lot of risk factors for amputation. Most significantly is foot ulcerations. We found that 85% of diabetic amputations are preceded by a foot ulceration. The risk of a patient developing an ulceration as a diabetic is 15 to 25%. And we find that the prevalence of an ulceration is 4 to 10% at any given time. We also know that approximately 15% of all ulcerations will result in osteomyelitis. The types of ulcerations themselves do have an impact on survivability in terms of amputation and mortality. Neuropathic ulcerations have a better rate of have a better risk of amputation than, say, an ischemic ulceration. And so because of that, we have to make decisions on which physical exam components are going to help us isolate those risks better. And so we know that someone that's got a positive loss of protective threshold will have a risk of amputation, or of ulceration rather, that's 5 times greater than someone who has intact protective threshold. We also know that as you add in the various levels of deformity plus neuropathy or any other constellation, you'll see that there's an increase in risk, where two or more factors is going to have a risk greater than 35 and up to 78%. So Healthy People 2010 initially looked at the information based on 1997 data and said that our rate of diabetic amputation is 4.1 per 1,000 diabetics. They then took a little bit closer look at the data, especially once they got a hold of 2000 census information, and came to the conclusion it's more realistically 6.6 per 1,000 at that time. So regardless, the information that we're really caring about at this point is that we want to reduce this rate of amputation in the U.S. by 55% by 2010. Now, there's several ways to go about this, and one of the things that we're proposing with the Amputation Prevention Initiative is that improved processes may be the key. Improved screening exams as well as improved referral patterns will enable us to have better results, we believe. One such paper that came out has demonstrated in the VA system that a negative correlation, very strong negative correlation with patients who receive correct exams and appropriate referrals and major amputations. Also, Italy is another example where they've instituted some changes, where they have a prevalence that's lower than what we have in the U.S. However, by going in with a more aggressive screening program and coming up with a dedicated algorithm for how to manage diabetics, especially once they manifested an ulceration, they were able to reduce their hospital days significantly, and they were able to reduce their limb amputations by 43%. So now that we've kind of covered that, I'm going to turn things over to the other Dr. Cook.
Hi, can everyone hear me? So, you know, Jeremy's talked about just trying to understand the idea of how severe amputations are in diabetics, specifically in Massachusetts, but you can correlate it to the United States, and identifying the high-risk groups. But now what we're really going to do is talk about prevention strategies and some information that we've been able to gather and how we've been able to try to affect policy. So, as mentioned yesterday, there's lots of ways you can try to prevent amputations, and there's some that you can control and there's some that are challenging to control, such as this individual. And although you can counsel him not to smoke and drink and eat too much and not go barefoot outside, some patients will still do this. So something that's a little bit easier to control that we can study a little bit more effectively is physicians. So as Jeremy had mentioned, if you look at all the literature, there's three common themes to preventing amputations that appears to work rather well, and that's preventive foot exams, the use of guidelines to manage your foot exams, and also using a multidisciplinary approach. And by doing those, your goal is to focus on risk factors, identifying risk factors that lead to an amputation. And the overwhelming thing is there's a lot of them. There's a lot of risk factors. So how do you go about identifying all of these different things? You can at least focus on some that are the most important. For instance, diabetic foot ulcers. We know that they're one of the leading causes of an amputation. Usually there's a foot ulcer before there's an amputation in a diabetic patient. So if you can identify patients that have risk factors for ulceration, you can then identify and try to prevent amputations. And if you haven't read this article by Reiber and colleagues in 1999, it's a really good article. And they're one of the first people to really talk about pathways to developing a foot ulcer. So what they did is they identified all of these different possible risk factors. And what they found is that there wasn't just usually one problem. There was a multitude, a pathway that was involved. And they found about 57 different pathways. And the most common was a patient that had neuropathy plus foot deformity plus some sort of injury. That injury could be improper shoes, for instance. And those three things in combination led to a foot ulcer. So there's already something that's very modifiable in our profession, and that's foot or shoe wear. And so if you can change that one part of the pathway and block it, you can block a foot ulcer and hence an amputation. So how do we do this? We have to teach our patients, we have to do diabetic foot screenings. And fortunately, the ADA, the American Diabetes Association, is recommending at this point that every single diabetic patient should have an annual comprehensive lower extremity foot exam. Every single patient, at least once a year. And if they have risk factors, and many of them have risk factors, they should be having more frequent exams. We don't monitor this very well. I mean, we're told this is what we should be doing, but we really don't monitor this. The best thing that we have is the BRFSS system. If you're not familiar with it, what they basically do is they randomly call patients and they ask them different questions. And when you have, for instance, a patient that says that they are diabetic, then there's another slew of questions that they're asked. And one of them is they ask if they recall having their foot examined in the past 12 months. So it's based on patient recall over the past 12 months. They also have to have a landline telephone. So there's other problems with BRFSS data, but it's the best thing that we have. So nationally, I showed this yesterday. This is what it looks like. Most patients, about 65 to 75% of the patients recall having had their socks and shoes removed to be examined. Massachusetts, it was 76.8 in 2003. But that means that there's a fair amount that don't recall having a foot exam. And they also ask about self-foot exams. And there's a large percentage that don't do self-foot exams either. The other problem is that that's just asking, do you remember having your socks and shoes removed, essentially? It has nothing to do about the quality. It's just looking at frequency. And we know that the quality is very important, because if you're not doing a proper foot exam, you're not going to identify the risk factors that can lead to an amputation. So this comprehensive diabetic foot exam is not well defined. If you look at the ADA clinical practice guidelines, there's about 98 pages. Embedded within that, there's about 2 pages with 2 different publications. If you can piece those together, you piece together this, and this is your comprehensive diabetic foot exam. To a primary care physician, this is an impossible feat. This is not going to be gathered in their mind to be able to do a diabetic foot exam. So they're expected to do all of this. Patient history, these were the key questions that are embedded in those 98 pages. They should be asking, have they had a prior foot ulcer, prior foot infection or amputation? Do patients inspect their feet on a daily basis? Ask questions about peripheral neuropathy or peripheral arterial disease. Then for the neurologic exam, the goal is to find out, is protective sensation present? Do they have a loss of protective sensation? They recommend doing 2 things. The 5.07 monofilament plus something else, plus either the vibratory test, the pinprick sensation, or ankle reflexes. So the combination of those is what the ADA is recommending. For peripheral arterial disease, they're asking you to do a bunch of screening questions, but then also to palpate pedal pulses. If pedal pulses are absent or you're not sure if they're absent, they recommend doing an ankle brachial index, which Dr. Durest has already pointed out has several problems, especially with diabetic patients with calcified blood vessels. So they recommend to order additional tests as necessary. For the musculoskeletal examination, it's expected for this comprehensive exam that you should look for evidence of increased pressure, so look for evidence of callus. Foot deformity, is the foot rigid? Look at range of motion, specifically ankle joint, subtalar joint, and MPJ, and assess their gait and balance. Finally, look at their socks and their shoes. Are the patients wearing appropriate socks and shoes, especially for their foot type? And then finally, educate them. After you do all of this, you should be educating your patients, having a list of do's and don'ts, and so forth. So this is a lot of things to ask a primary care physician to do, given the other things that they have to do within that same exam. And finally then, they want you to risk classify and stratify these patients. This is the ADA risk classification system. There's a lot of different classification systems. It's confusing because everyone uses different things. We're not sure which one to use. But this is the ADA one, and basically it's categorized by looking at the big players, so loss of protective sensation, peripheral arterial disease, deformity. Just having a prior history of an ulcer amputation puts you at a very high risk category. Based on that, they have suggestions for what the recommended treatments are at a minimum and the follow-up durations. So at least this is helpful to see what the ADA is recommending on a national basis. So you can imagine that asking a primary care physician to do this is rather challenging. There's a lot of things that are going on. There's a lot of barriers to actually being able to accomplish this. You know, if you buy into the guidelines for the ADA, that's great, but a lot of people don't. And so there's multiple guidelines out there. You don't know which one to use. They disagree with each other to make it even more confusing. And then there's physician knowledge on what they believe is more important. And then their time is a huge, huge problem, which I'll go into in a minute. The priority of the foot exam, if they're not having a problem with their foot, is going to be lower as opposed to adjusting their diabetic medications, for example. And the foot exam, again, isn't well defined. It's embedded within all these pages of their clinical practice guidelines. So looking at the time, because we found that to be really interesting, at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, we looked at what primary care physicians are allowed for follow-up visits in new patients. And they're given an option for follow-up appointments, they're given 10 to 20 minutes per patient. For new patients, it's considered a long appointment, they're given 20 to 30 minutes. And we found out by asking other physicians, this is actually very generous. Some in other institutions have much less time than this. And so you can imagine they have to prioritize the chief complaint of the patient, which may be back pain, could be absolutely nothing related to diabetes. And then they're trying to check glycemic control, talk about hemoglobin A1C, blood pressure control, lipids, you know, have you had a dilated eye exam? And then finally somewhere, oh, comprehensive foot exam. So this is, I think, a real great opportunity for us to help our primary care physician colleagues. We did a quick little pilot study just to get an idea. We took 11 primary care physicians that were willing, And we taught them the ADA clinical practice guidelines of what's recommended for a comprehensive lower extremity exam. We showed them exactly what they need to do. They got to do a couple of drive runs, and then when they were ready and they felt comfortable with it, we timed them. And we had them examine a normal foot following these ADA comprehensive clinical practice guidelines. And it took them about almost 11 minutes with giving them everything, giving them and telling them exactly what to do and practicing it in advance on a normal patient. In the literature, there's not a lot about time. We know it's a big problem, but there's not a lot out there. We know there's one publication that came out that showed that the mean duration of a visit for diabetes was a little over 17 minutes. And then in the UK, there is a paper out on a diabetes mini clinic, and all they do is, it's just for diabetes, and they spend an average of 30 minutes for a lower limb screening in that study. So, in regards to other problems, looking at the quality of the exam, we wanted to find out what's going on right now, asking primary care physicians, what are they doing right now in the state of Massachusetts? And so our primary aim of we did a survey of different physicians in Massachusetts at first, and then we wanted to identify components of the foot exam that they're already doing. We also had a bunch of secondary aims, which I'll show in a minute. So we divided this survey into three main categories. One was looking at the examination of the foot, the second was looking at comfort level, and the third was looking at referral patterns. So again, these were general practitioners. We used the ADA clinical practice guidelines from 2007, and that was for all of the different categories, and then we pre-tested this with those same 11 primary care physicians. So for the ADA clinical practice guidelines, we basically broke it into four main key processes: neurologic, vascular, derm, and musculoskeletal. So for example, for a primary care physician to meet the vascular key process, they needed to palpate pedal pulses on a regular basis and also assess for gangrene. So if they put that they do both of those and they met the key process for vascular. Again, I just want to emphasize this was a non-funded convenience sample. These were general practitioners attending a CME meeting called Diabetes in Depth in Boston. And so this was in collaboration with the American Diabetes Association, and we gave them paper surveys that the primary care physicians were kind enough to fill out. It was completely anonymous. We were not allowed to identify the primary care physicians, and so they put some stipulations on us. They did allow us to just make sure that they were indeed general practitioners, they were currently practicing in the year 2008, and that they weren't involved with a wound care center. So our response rate was good. It was 77%, which was 149 primary care physicians in the state of Massachusetts. And we found that vascular was the most common key component that they're routinely doing. If they're going to do something, it's going to usually be vascular, followed by derm, and then neurologic. And musculoskeletal was a steep drop-off. Then we wanted to look to see if they routinely include all processes, because technically they should be doing all of them, not just one. And we found there was a low percent of people doing all of the processes, and it was 2%. And this is self-reported. This isn't going out and measuring what they're actually doing. This is what they're reporting to us that they routinely do on a daily basis. And in their self-report, there was almost 29% that are telling us, I don't do any of these at all. And if they are going to do them, they routinely do about one. If they're going to do anything, it's usually one key process. In regards to comfort level, we were asking them, how comfortable are you with doing a diabetic foot exam when a patient comes into your office? Most of them put that they're somewhat comfortable. This was a Likert-type questionnaire. And so the majority felt somewhat comfortable. There was a small percent that said that they weren't comfortable at all. We wanted to see, does this correlate, this comfort level, does it correlate with the number of physical exam key processes? So in other words, do more comfortable physicians routinely do more key processes? Do they do a better exam? And we found that no, not at all. In fact, those that said they were very comfortable, there was one of the smallest percents that did more than two key processes. With referrals, we also asked them reasons for referrals, why they would refer a diabetic patient to a foot specialist. There is a percentage of them that report that as soon as they have a patient that's first diagnosed with diabetes, they're going to refer to a foot specialist. But a large percent, over 77%, are saying that they wait until there's a foot ulcer. There's something that's a real complication before they're going to refer to a foot specialist. Then what we wanted to ask is, well, if they're less comfortable with doing a diabetic foot exam, are they just referring more? You know, I don't feel comfortable with this, so I'm just going to refer it out. We were wondering if that was the case. And we really didn't find a correlation with that either based on this survey. So then we wanted to get a sense, not just in Massachusetts, but in every state that we could do this survey. And so based on every state that was doing this diabetes in-depth CME program, we were able to distribute this survey. Those were paper surveys in the red box. But because of the time constraints involved with the CME meeting, the bottom two states, Arizona and Florida, they requested that we do an electronic response format or not do it at all. So we at least elected to do it electronically up when we were giving our lecture, as opposed to not having any data. But it did create some problems. So if you look at the different key processes, the most common theme overall was generally vascular, followed by derm and neurologic, and musculoskeletal in all of the states had a steep drop-off. But because it was an electronic format, they wouldn't let us change it for Arizona and Florida. You couldn't tell if the same person was checking off the same thing. It was just one response out of 100 for each type of category. So because of that, we couldn't calculate if they were doing the derm key process. And it was also the same problem with the referral category. And then if you look at the number of key processes by state, we could only really look at those that were paper surveys. And you can see that even across other states, it was generally the average number of key processes conducted was generally 1 to 2. Comfort level by state, it was most of them feel somewhat comfortable. For some reason, Florida had a lot of very comfortable. Don't know why, but it was generally some and then very and then a small amount that were not comfortable at all. And this is just an example of why we couldn't calculate referrals in looking at correlating it among the same person. It's because we only had it out of 100 for each type of response. So referrals by states, looking at the paper surveys, again, the majority are waiting until there's a foot ulcer before they then involve a foot specialist. And then there's about 10 to 20% that are doing it right when a patient's first diagnosed with diabetes. So with limitations to the survey, we just want to stress this was a convenient sample. It was those attending this diabetes in-depth meeting. We couldn't do any regression models because we were not able to calculate or collect demographics based on the PriMed stipulations for the CME meeting. So we could only tell that they were actively practicing in 2008 in that state and that they weren't part of a wound care center. But we couldn't ask the age of the physician, the volume of diabetics they see, and so forth. We weren't allowed to ask those things. We do have some small sample sizes within the states. We would have liked to have larger samples. This is self-reported. And then we had the different survey mechanisms, paper versus electronic, for Arizona and Florida. But the take-home points here is that at least in our state, in Massachusetts, there's a small percent that are including all of the key exam processes, and that was similar across the other states that were paper. There's also a large percentage that are self-reporting that they don't do any of the key processes, almost 30% if you look at all of those different states. And if they are going to do something, it's usually 1 to 2, usually vascular. Musculoskeletal is rare. And most feel somewhat comfortable, and if they are going to involve a multidisciplinary approach, they're waiting until there's a foot ulcer. So what does this mean to all of us? I think it means that we have a public health responsibility here. We have a real reason to jump in. Right now, we're all practicing reactionary medicine. We're waiting until there's a problem, and we need to really switch to preventive medicine. Of course, it's important to know what to do when a foot ulcer comes into our clinic, but we need to really stress the importance of preventive screening exams. And it has to involve everyone. So it means that we need to educate our primary care physicians. We need to educate our patients. We need to, when we do have a patient, make sure we're doing the proper comprehensive foot exam when a patient does come in and risk stratify them and communicate that back to the primary care physician so they understand where we are valuable to them. We can do a lot of other things in addition to that, asking patients their hemoglobin A1C levels and other things. We need to help out our primary care physician colleagues. There's just too many things for them to handle. And when they see our valuable input in our role, they're going to involve us more. So what Jeremy and I have done is we've taken some of this information, and we were fortunate enough to be invited to join a task force on the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. It's called the Healthy Massachusetts Compact, and it's their disease management and wellness section. It involves a lot of different people. The Secretary of Health and Human Services, a lot of different state agencies, every insurance company in the state attends this meeting, and we essentially did monthly meetings, so for 15 months between 2008 and 2009. There are 63 members of this task force, including us. The goals of this Healthy Mass Compact were really broad. It was, you know, ensure access to health care, make sure that access or health care quality is good, that we try to contain health care costs, and promote individual wellness, and promote healthy communities. So very, very vague, open-ended goals. What they first did, though, is they wanted to target chronic diseases and specifically diabetes. They focused on diabetes because of the amount of cost that they were enduring within the state. And so what their goal is to create a role model for diabetes and then to apply it to other chronic diseases like asthma and other things like that. So with diabetes in general, again, very broad purposes that were similar to the other, but what they wanted to do is short-term outcomes. They needed something to measure very quickly. So amputations is not a good outcome measure because you have to wait a long time before you know whether or not a patient's going to develop an amputation. So they needed what they call real-time outcomes. And then that would serve as a proxy for whether or not they're receiving comprehensive diabetes care and hopefully preventing complications in the future. So we're really fortunate that they chose four things to measure. And one of them is whether or not they're getting a foot exam, a comprehensive foot exam. They were debating on all types of different things to measure. And right now, one of them is a foot exam. So we're very, very fortunate for that. We're very happy. The other things that the state is now measuring is whether or not they're getting an annual dilated eye exam, a biannual hemoglobin A1C, and whether or not their patient is getting a flu vaccine once a year. So they're hoping that these will increase, and they're going to base it on the behavioral risk factor surveillance system. So they'll be randomly calling patients and asking this every year for their short-term outcomes. And then they also want to decrease the number of people who are not diagnosed with diabetes or pre-diabetes. So this is currently their baseline, and they're hoping that these are going to change. This is what they're going to base everything on right now. So you can see with foot exam, we're about, you know, a little bit over 60 to 65%, and they're hoping that that's going to go up, and they want all four processes to go up significantly. So what they did is we had to come up with recommendations and then action plans and figure out barriers to those action plans. So they came up with several different ones. I was just going to share them with you so you could see what they're recommending right now. So the first recommendation was to help providers adhere to guidelines, which is very vague. And what they're doing is they're promoting one guideline. It's essentially the ADA guidelines that I was showing you. So the action steps are to educate providers, and what they're doing is they're creating little packets they're going to be sending to primary care physicians. They're going to really target providers that are in high-risk areas that have high-risk problems, and they're going to be initiating a lot of CME credits for this in the future. And again, the barriers were realizing there's lots of different guidelines, so they're promoting one set of guidelines across the state. And then they're also identifying best practices, which was very controversial, but they're identifying best practices and then contacting those and having those individuals talk to others that they feel are struggling, specifically in Western Massachusetts, where they feel that they're not as integrated with the other large communities and institutions. The second recommendation was to implement system changes that will facilitate a coordinated, multidisciplinary team approach to care. So one of the things that they're at least going to try is to, that we're recommending to eliminate or decrease co-pays and deductibles for diabetic patients needing specialty care, such as us, test strips for glucose, self-management education, and nutrition information. The other thing, we're encouraging system changes within the providers. They're trying to provide incentives to establish networks for people that are in solo or private practice. They want to create collaboratives among specialties with primary care physicians. With labs, they're asking labs to create standing orders so that you don't have to have a primary care physician remember to order a hemoglobin A1C test. It's just going to be a standard order. And then for insurers, one of the big things that came out of this is that, you know, primary care physicians get these reports on compliance, and it's very confusing and overwhelming, and they get these from multiple insurance carriers. So we're trying to get them to integrate this into one report or a couple of reports that are very easy for them to interpret so that there can be some sort of, you know, actual helpful feedback. For the third recommendation, they're wanting to work on the workplace for patients and to help those with diabetes. So an example, they're doing on-site flu vaccines for employers. They're creating toolkits that they're giving to different businesses. We're endorsing legislation that expands coverage for those that needs to include lifestyle interventions, so providing incentives for making sure patients have some coverage for joining a gym, for instance. The fourth recommendation was to develop a high-level statewide education campaign targeting high-risk groups. And so what they're doing, or we're doing, is we're currently assessing the education programs that are already out there and trying to identify the ones that are most effective. So this might be a way where we could also share our information on other things that we've done through our own division, own specialty, to show them how we can help in this initiative. And then they're going to just help with this. The fifth recommendation is to increase the number of patients with diabetes who receive diabetes self-management education and medical nutrition therapy. So there's been a lot of problems with this. I don't want to go into all of that, but they're doing a lot of things for that. And then the sixth recommendation is to ensure that appropriate staffing levels, training programs, certification resources exist to all the different services that are needed for a diabetic patient or a pre-diabetic patient. So they're trying to increase the number of certified diabetes educators. They're trying to increase the number of diabetic self-management education programs that are available. There's not enough of them in Massachusetts. There's a lot of reasons for that. There's a lot of barriers, and it's really a problem in some of the underserved areas. So they're going to be really focusing on that as well. So we just want to thank again Dr. DiResta for starting all of this in the Amputation Prevention Initiative. Without him, it wouldn't exist. And we hope that we can continue working on this as I've showed you. So thank you.